This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TriDot Podcast. A lot of people say that they could never do a triathlon because they fear the swim. If people have the courage to try the sport, they often say that swimming is one of the biggest obstacles. And then there are the athletes that can swim, but they're always chasing a faster swim split. We have two pure swimmers with us today who are going to give us some swimming insight to help us triathletes have better success in the water. Dee Dee Griesbauer grew up in the water and set records in swimming from a young age. She accumulated 10 NCAA All-American honors at Stanford, was a member of the USA Swim national team, and was a gold medalist at the 1989 Pan Pacific Championships and the 1991 Pan American Games in backstroke. Before transitioning to a successful career in triathlon, she narrowly missed the Barcelona Olympic team. Welcome back to the TriDot Podcast, Dee Dee.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. It's great to be back.
We also have with us professional triathlete Tim O'Donnell. Tim joined his first swim team at the age of 5 and eventually set multiple school records, earned repeated district championships and all-state honors as the captain of the varsity swim team. He swam for 2 full seasons at the United States Naval Academy before committing to the sport of triathlon and becoming one of the world's most successful and experienced American long course triathletes. Tim, it's great to have you back on the podcast. And you are now coaching with TriDot for Team Salty Bears. How is that going?
Thanks, Vanessa. Well, first, I just have to say, reading my swimming resume after Dee Dee's just made me feel a little bit bad about myself. Luckily, I was only... It's like, here's Dee Dee and all of her accomplishments, and then Tim is also here. It's like, oh. I feel like I'm on a podcast with Rennie, you know, reading Rennie's accomplishments. Then I got... Story of my life. But no, Vanessa, it is awesome to be here, and it's been a blast this year getting Team Salty Bears off the ground and starting coaching one-on-one myself as well. So, you know, I was out at Ironman Texas a couple weeks ago, 42,512. That number is how many steps I took running around the run course yelling at all of our athletes. So I didn't know that I was going to get so much training in being a coach, but it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is incredible. That's a long day, isn't it? I think it's actually harder to be a support person than it is to actually do the race itself.
Definitely.
Well, I'm Vanessa, the average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. We are going to start off, as usual, with our warm-up question, settle in for our main set topic, and then wind things down with a cool-down.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
How much do y'all love watching sports? And when you get to see it live, there is nothing like being part of an amazing and passionate crowd. For our warm-up question today, I am curious what our two professional triathletes will say. If you could watch one major sporting event live, what would you choose and where would it be located? Let's start with you, Tim.
Oh, wow. I mean, I think you got to say the Super Bowl, right? You can't beat that. And somewhere warm where it's outdoors. You know, I don't want it in a dome.
That sounds perfect. What about you, Dee Dee? Which sporting event would you want to get?
My husband will divorce me for not saying the Ryder Cup because he is a golfer through and through. My answer, honestly, having been a part of the event 2 times, would be the U.S. Olympic swim trials. I think there is no more emotionally charged meet because there's always someone you've never heard of who's going to have the race of their lives and become an Olympian. And then someone who has been at the top of the sport forever is going to have a rough day and suddenly their hopes and dreams get, you know, dashed. And this year in particular, they're hosting the Olympic trials this summer at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. So it's actually in a proper like football stadium. They're building a pool in the middle of it. So the capacity is going to be enormous. And There's for me, there's nothing like the U.S. Olympic swim trials. It's just such an emotional meet.
I actually got shivers all over my body when you're describing that. So I think maybe I might have to visit this sporting event at some point in my lifetime. That's an awesome answer. I love that.
Shivers about Super Bowl.
I go first. I go first, and Didi, it still makes me look bad after the fact. Do you guys should log off? Do you even need me on this podcast?
Oh yeah,
Didi's got this. Didi's got this.
We need you, Tio. We need you. I think for me, I'm going to go with the epically Canadian answer here, and say the Olympic gold medal game in hockey, and Canada has to be playing. That's number one. And the location obviously has to be somewhere in Canada, because I have this very fond memory of when the Olympics were in Vancouver, and my husband and I actually went to the Olympics to watch one of our friends compete in speed skating, long course speed skating. And we were on our way home during the Olympic medal, gold medal game, and we were in the airport, and it was overtime, and no one was getting on the plane. Like, they were calling people and paging everyone, and the waiting room was just getting more and more people, and no one was actually leaving because it was so exciting. And when Canada finally scored the winning goal, everyone ran away, and it was like a ghost town. It was crazy. So I can only imagine how it would have felt to been in that actual crowd, and the energy just must have been indescribable. So that's my answer. I'll be posting this question on the I Am Trout Facebook community page, and I can hardly wait to see your answers. So make sure you're a member of this group so you can be a part of this and many other swim, bike, run conversations with thousands of other athletes who love triathlon as much as we all do.
On to the main set, going in 3, 2, 1.
Before we get too deep into the show today, I want to give a shout out to our good friends at UCAN. Here at TriDot, we are huge believers in using UCAN to fuel our training and racing. In the crowded field of nutrition companies, what separates UCAN from the pack is the science behind Live Steady, the key ingredient in UCAN products. While most energy powders are filled with sugar or stimulants that cause a spike and crash, UCAN energy powders, powered by Live Steady, deliver a steady release of complex carbs to give you stable blood sugar and provide long-lasting energy. I am so excited to get my shipment of UCAN products. Their energy bars are out of this world. Between their energy mix, energy bars, almond butter, and more, there is definitely a Live Steady product that you will love. So head over to their website, ucan.co, that's UCAN.co, and use the code TRIDOT to save 20% on your entire order. It used to be 10%, but the fine folks at UCAN have upped it to 20% off for TRIDOT Nation. So once again, that's ucan.co, promo code TRIDOT. My days in the pool as a kid revolved around typical swim lessons, you know, doing handstands, creating synchronized swim routines with my sister, and retrieving things from the bottom of the pool. And I don't consider myself to have a swim background. And I think if you were to ask a group of triathletes if they started swimming as an adult, the majority of them would raise their hands and call themselves adult onset swimmers. The swim is something that most triathletes say we get through so that we can hop on our beloved bikes and into our favorite running shoes. So what can we learn from two professional triathletes with pure swim backgrounds? Hopefully they will be able to share their experiences and help us non-swimmers learn to love the swim as much as the bike and run. Tim, Didi, you have less than an hour to convert us all to swim lovers. So are you up for the task?
I mean, I've been married to Rini for 10 years and she's still not a swim lover. So I don't know how much I can get done in an hour, but let's go. Let's do it.
Okay. That's perfect. So both of you started swimming at a very young age. Did your parents put you in swim lessons, or was it something that you asked to do as a child? Tim, let's start with you.
Well, Vanessa, I was the youngest of four, so I didn't get asked to do anything. I just had to go with the flow. And we were living in Northern California at the time. We joined the summer league swim team called the Roseville Sugar Bears. And, you know, my siblings were going to practice, so they asked, how young could you be? And they said, yeah, sure, five's fine. So they threw me in there with them, and that started it all.
That's awesome. And so is there any relationship from Sugar Bears to Salty Bears?
I think maybe like subconsciously there was, because I always loved that name. It was just, we, you know, as Salty Bears, we wanted to be fun, lighthearted, family oriented. And yeah, maybe subconsciously that's everything I loved about the Sugar Bears. So it's a little nod, I think, to that first swim team.
I love that. I also love that you're the youngest of four kids. That must have been pretty awesome growing up in a family with so many kids.
I got beat up a lot.
Yeah. And that's why you're such a good athlete, right?
Yeah, builds resiliency.
Exactly. Didi, what about you?
Yeah, I think for me, it was a similar environment. My swim career started with summer league swimming, but I learned to swim before I joined the team. So it was a water safety thing. I think it's a healthy choice for any parent to make sure that your child is safe in the water. And by my recollection, one of my first bathing suits, I mean, it could have been more than three. It had a hamburger and French fries on it. And just the sheer act of putting on the hamburger and French fries swimsuit, like, made me excited to go to the pool. So I loved it from the start.
So I'm just thinking, first tip, if you want to love swimming, you need to purchase a bathing suit with a hamburger and French fries on it. Obviously.
Well, or whatever your favorite food or thing is. And you can certainly get just about anything on a swimsuit these days.
Right? Oh, that's priceless. I love that so much. Now, both of you have had a lot of success in the pool from your early swim days through to college and beyond. What is one of your favorite memories from your days in the pool?
You know, certainly the experiences, kind of similar to triathlon. I got to travel the world with swimming and have experiences that I wouldn't likely have had otherwise. But honestly, the thing I take away, it's funny because the thing you live day in and day out is, oh, I missed, you know, that one rep by a tenth of a second, and you wear that like a hair shirt. But now, all these years later, removed from my swim career, the things I remember are, you know, the experiences with my teammates and the relationships with my teammates. My Stanford swim teammates to this day remain some of my closest friends. And when we pick up the phone, even though we don't talk every day, it's like nothing's changed. And so it's those relationships and the things that we experience together, winning NCAA championships and really traveling the world together to go to remarkable places and swim against other people from other countries. It's a life-changing experience. So yeah, the medals and the records are all great memories, but the thing that I take with me the most is the experiences with my teammates.
I 100% agree. With being on any team, I think that there's just something about working towards a common goal. And in swimming, you're still in an individual sport, but you're still a team. And so going through those experiences with your teammates, it solidifies those bonds quite in an amazing way. So I can totally understand why that's what you remember from your days in the pool. Tim, how about you?
Obviously, as a kid, the social aspect for me was awesome. I loved the kids that were on the team with me. But when Didi was talking about team, that really struck something with me as well. I was a distance swimmer, and the distance swimmers, we always stuck together. We're usually in the end lane, you know, doing the longer sets. And I remember one night at Navy, our coach gave the distance swimmers, the main set was like 9,500 meters, just the main set. And all the other swimmers from the other stroke discipline swimmers, everything, they're all at dinner. I think our coach even left, and the lights go off, and there's just like his office light is on and like a couple like safety lights, and we're just grinding away. And I'm like, I love them. Like, yes, like, this is us. Everybody else is eating dinner, like being weak, and this is us getting stronger. And I don't know, that was just really a cool moment for me to just know that you're working hard when other people aren't. And fast forward to last year, I have another favorite. This isn't just as a swimmer, but another favorite team moment. With the JDC and Julie Dibbins crew, we were doing relays. And the relay was 50 meter sprint, get out. You had a power walk to the slides in the well. And one of my teammates, I can't remember her name. I think maybe rhymes with Gigi. Well, she jumps on this. She power walks up to the slides. not realizing hops in the slide that's broken, that's out of order. There's no running water on this slide. If anybody knows, I'm obviously talking about Dee Dee. So seeing Dee Dee slowly come out of this acrylic tube, like her skin, like smoking from the skin burns and just flopping into the pool, might have been the most favorite moment I've ever had in a swimming pool in my entire life.
The sound of my butt cheeks sliding down yes. the plastic is one of those things that we're never going to unhear.
That sound will haunt me for the rest of my life.
See, so fun, even if it's at my expense.
That is so great. I love that so much. Now, Tim, what did you learn from swimming that you have incorporated into your time as a pro?
As I look back at my swimming career, probably more now so as I've gone through my triathlon career, but I was a pretty bullheaded swimmer, and I did focus on working hard and only working hard. And I had coaches that really embraced that when I was younger. I did have one coach in high school that tried to get me out of it and tried to get me to focus more on my stroke, my technique, my efficiency. I wish I had paid more attention to that looking backwards now. And it's not really something I take with me. It's a lesson I took with me of a mistake I made when I was a swimmer. So I learned that. And for running, I really did. I worked with running specialists and really focused on becoming a more efficient, better runner. And, I think having that lesson from swimming where I finally realized that, hey, I could have been a better swimmer if I had not just tried to be the hardest worker, but try to be, the most efficient and best athlete overall.
Dee Dee, what is something that you've learned through swimming that has become a part of who you are as a professional triathlete?
Yeah, I think, when I was presented with the opportunity to race professionally as a triathlete, I was so excited about it because I saw it. First of all, it had never occurred to me that that was a thing that I could do because there was quite a gap between when I finished swimming and when I started triathlon. So when I finished my swim career, I just thought, well, my life as an athlete is over. So being presented with the opportunity to be an athlete again was such a gift. And I thought, well, gosh, isn't this great? I can correct a lot of the things that I feel like I could have done better in my swimming career. And one of them, I mentioned it before, we're all competitive. We're driven with big goals. And I would leave a workout focusing on the one rep that I missed by a tenth of a second. And I would just dwell on that one rep for the rest of the day. And I would wear it and it would bother me. And it would literally alter my mood for a long time until I could get back in the pool and fix it. And I think as a triathlete, none of us loves to have a bad session or, have to pull the plug on a workout because you're just failing miserably. But I've learned to take that a little bit. And it's going to happen with all we train, three different sports, varying degrees of intensity on any given day. You're going to have a session or a repeat or whatever that just doesn't fall your way. And I think taking that in stride and in perspective and just leaving it with the session and moving on is something that I've taken from my swim career. It's something I didn't do very well in swimming that I think I do a better job in triathlon.
That really resonates with me because I think that's something that I focus on a lot in my own training is I'm really, really hard on myself. And I tend to do what you did as a swimmer is that you take it with you and you wear it for the rest of your day. I'm just curious, is there anything that you have done to allow yourself to separate that? So when you finish your workout, is there something that you say to yourself or is there some kind of a separation technique that you use to allow yourself to move forward and not take it with you for the rest of the day?
Well, part of the blessing of triathlon is that there's always another workout just in a few hours. So there's really not time.
You don't have time to dwell.
You can't dwell. You've got to finish the session, get home, get something to eat, change your gear, and get out the door for the next session. So part of it is just a simply time management.
That's perfect. I love it. That's great. let's dive into the swimming specifics now. So for an athlete that is a pure swimmer like Tim and Dee Dee were in college, What does a week of training look like versus a triathlete training for three different sports? Tim, let's go to you.
Well, I just want to put a little caveat here. I do believe swim training has changed drastically since I swam full-time. It definitely has changed drastically since Didi swam full-time, because that was a long, long time ago.
She snapped on our caps. Just kidding. We didn't.
For us, it was, you know, we would swim doubles several times a week, 6 to 7 days in the water, really a week, plus the doubles. I know our training trips at Navy, the distance swimmers were doing, you know, well over 100K a week, those weeks. So pretty high volume. We did a lot of strength training. I remember at the Olympic Training Center also watching, I think it's Team Wolverine, which Phelps and Eric Fenton, a lot of those Olympians were on. They seem to be in the water twice a week and doing, you know, just kind of at least one separate dry land session. So three sessions a week, but it's a lot of staring at that black line. I tell you what, I never really minded, you know, doing a long ride, because I knew the alternative was staring at a black line for three or four hours. So it was all good.
That's why you should have been a backstroker, Tim. We got to look at the sky.
I ran. You see my head tilt. I ran. I same thing when I do backstroke, right into the lane line every time. My rudder is not straight, Didi.
Didi, what about you? Was your swim training? How was it different than what you do as a professional triathlete now?
Yeah, as Tim pointed out, the swim training has evolved in such an incredible way. And actually, one of my Stanford teammates' daughters came and trained with us one summer when she was home from college and she swam with us. And I was picking her brain a little bit. She was swimming at Stanford. And I was picking her brain a little bit about like what their training was like. And I was just like, wow, like swimming must be fun now. Because when we swam, it was. You know, at minimum 20 to 22 hours a week in the water, 10 sessions to two and a half hours, plus 3 days in the weight room, plus 2 days of dry land, which for us was running, which for most swimmers, I mean, that's actually what got me to love running was our swim coach used to make us run as cross training for swimming. And most swimmers really don't, particularly the breaststrokers with the knees, don't love to run, but I all of a sudden was introduced to running and I was like, oh, this is amazing. But so then we had these two dry land sessions, which was just running stadium stairs, stretch cords, pull-ups, things like that, that were not in the weight room, but outside of that. So I had a conversation with somebody at one point and swimmers, I hope it's different than triathlon. Swimmers overtrain their distance. I mean, Tim and I have just outlined Tim swimming 100K weeks for a race that was a mile, right? Like, so he's training 25 hours a week for a race that takes 15 minutes. I was training 20 to 25 hours a week in the pool for a race that takes 2 minutes. So swimmers tend to overtrain their distance more than I think any other sport. And there's a value in that there's frequency and repetition, but it's also some insane hours for a race that really takes such a small amount of time.
That is so true. That's not something that I actually thought of before, but when you're thinking about a short course race and swimming, that is a lot of training for, like you said, for seconds, right? It's sometimes under a minute that all of those swims take. So that is something that's interesting. I find it also interesting that it seems like in whatever sport you're doing, there is that aspect of overtraining. And in particular, I mean, overtraining is rampant in the triathlon world, unless you're a triathlon athlete, of course. So it's fascinating to think that, yes, that there is overtraining everywhere. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. Now, this is something that I wonder about a lot. And you see this with age groupers and also with the pros like Lionel Saunders and Sam Long. I mean, these two are faster than most could dream of as an age grouper, but These two pros often talk about what a struggle it is for them in the water. So why is it so difficult for some people to improve their swim times when they don't have a pure swimming background?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors for sure. Honestly, like body type and muscle mass and bone density are all factors, right? The ability to activate your transverse abdominis and keep your hips up. Some people struggle with that, and maybe it's tightness in the body or, muscle composition. But these are all things that, you know, if your body's built one way, you can train really hard, but you might not respond the way as some others would with similar stimulus.
Yeah, I agree. I think my coaches always used to tell me that what made me a talented backstroker was the hypermobility of my shoulders. It was a blessing because my catch in the backstroke, I could reach deeper and catch more water because my shoulders were so hypermobile. The downside is that I spent a lot of my free time in the training room getting treatment on shoulder tendonitis and things like that. But there's a mobility thing that comes in, thoracic mobility, shoulder mobility, ankle mobility to be able to be a good kicker. I mean, I have a toe point like a ballerina, but I'm definitely not a ballerina in any way, shape, or form. But I made that toe point from 20 years of backstroke kicking and that ankle mobility. So there are some physiological restraints. And then I think when you are dealing with an adult onset swimmer, part of the challenge of swimming, it's easier if you're on a track trying to learn run drills, you can feel what your knees are doing, or you can feel what your elbows are doing. You can feel how if your foot's hitting the ground on the heel or the toe. When you're in the water, all of those feelings are distorted. The water distorts your sense of feel. So what feels like, you know, your coach can say, put your hand in the water here. You're like, I am. And then all of a sudden they take a picture. Like the water just distorts your sense of feeling. And so it's really hard when you're trying to think about where your body is and where it actually is. It's a big challenge.
That is so true.
And I remember watching film and being like, oh, really trying to work on a particular part of my stroke. And be like, oh, I nailed that. And then I see the film and I'm like, what was I doing?
Yeah, like big changes. You have to change something so big. Yeah. And like what you see is so small.
Yeah. And it goes both ways, right, too. Like that mobility, ankle mobility that you have from decades of swimming, it's not ideal for running either, right? So there's certain like body trade-offs that we all got to work with when we're doing this crazy sport of three sports that we call triathlon.
Right. You look at another pure swimmer in Lauren Brandon, and part of what makes her a great swimmer is she literally was born with flippers on her feet. She has ridiculously large feet. I mean, she's a tall woman, but for a woman her size, she has such large feet that I bet she wouldn't want that once you get to the marathon, right? Like you want to trade that in, right? It doesn't help her. So there are physiological issues. So, you know, working on technique and repetition and frequency of feel for the water, they can all help. But there are just certain things like what made Phelps amazing as a swimmer was the fact that his arms were just unusually long. What made Janet Evans great as a swimmer is that for someone of her body size, her lungs were just slightly too large and it made her a remarkable swimmer. So it's these physiological freakishness things that make us good swimmers, but don't necessarily apply to triathlon in general. So yeah.
I saw a great body comparison, like chart or photo of, it was Phelps and one of the great Kenyan runners. I can't recall who. And Phelps is what? Six something. Didi, what? 6'4"? I don't know.
I was going to say tall guy. Maybe. Yeah.
And this runner is like 5'4", maybe 5'6". Their inseams are the same length.
Oh,
so
wow.
This elite 2-hour marathon runner who's as tall as Rennie has these massive legs. And then Phelps has these short legs with this massive torso. But you find your way to the right sport.
Now, I'm curious, is it possible that there is a mindset that is unique to swimmers that impacts performance? Or do you think that improvement barriers, again, are more related to technique or some physiological factor?
Well, when you said mindset, I immediately went to breaststrokers. They have a different mindset. Sorry, all the breaststrokers.
What is it?
I don't know, man. Or a D, right? Like, breaststrokers are different, right?
And honestly, different it's breeds. Every stroke is different. Like, the sprinters are a little bit of odd ducks too, right? Like, every discipline, like, I would think of the peculiar ones. Yes, breaststrokers are a little bit unique, and sprinters are a little bit odd. Distance swimmers are definitely whack. Like, and I think the flyers and the backstrokers probably have the most in common, but every discipline has its own peculiarity about, and part of it is just the drastic nature of swim training and what you endure. And I think, you know, is there a particular mindset? Yeah, I think Tim's story about like the lights going out in the middle of a 12K session when everyone else is eating dinner and your immediate thought is, this is amazing. Like, that is a swimmer's mindset, in that I think there's so much monotony involved and so much repetition involved that your tolerance for that sort of thing, like, you can find amusement in the smallest thing. I think you're forced to have that camaraderie with your squad mates because there is so much monotony involved that, I think it's a super unique sport.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. If you're doing a long run, if you're at a high school cross country team and you're going for an hour run, you're chatting and there's interaction, but I've never calculated the actual time, but I imagine the percent of a swim practice that your head is in the water in complete silence, other than the sensory, you know, reactions of the water and bubbles. It's a unique skill that you have to build and develop to, you kind of manage that environment and how you handle it. And I do think it can make you strong. And when you are able to apply it in other means, like running a marathon or going out for 180K bike ride by yourself.
Yeah. The self-talk, like, you've got to get really good at your own inner dialogue.
Yeah, because you can't hide from it when you're underwater, right? That, like, there's nowhere to go. There's no one that can save you. It's you and your brain and the bubbles.
Bloop, bloop, bloop. And
I think it's important to note as well that when you are swimming, the ability to maintain focus for that long of a period of time, that is definitely a skill. And I think as society changes with our lack of ability to pay attention and to focus on something for so long, I think that's something that is unique to swimmers, now that you mention that and point that out. And it also boggles my mind that more swimmers haven't converted to the sport of triathlon because they have this built-in ability that they've been practicing for so many years. Why aren't they joining triathlon? Because they'd be really great triathletes with that amount of focus. So is there anything pure swimmers do in training that is different from how triathletes train for the swim? Should we mimic these things as triathletes or not?
I think one of the things that as swimmers, and we touched on it earlier, not in terms of it being a blessing, but the overtraining, because that's not the blessing, but the repetition and certainly the consistency, the frequency. So you develop that muscle memory by just doing something so frequently and repeated over and over and over. So maybe that means for triathlon that instead of running, you know, 3 days a week for, you know, 50 minutes to an hour, you do one run that's an hour and then some shorter runs so that you're doing it more frequency and getting in touch with that feel and that sort of repetition without adding miles necessarily. But I think consistency and repetition are some of the benefits to swim training that triathletes could benefit from.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think, Tim?
Well, the first thing that came to mind was kick sets. You don't quite do the kick sets that a swimmer or swim team would do. One of the things that I found, triathletes are always in a rush. You know, time is a very valuable commodity when you've got three sports to train for and you're training for an Ironman. And I noticed when I swim with triathletes, even when we try to do specific stuff, which I think swimmers have the advantage of, they can spend more time doing drills, working on specific strokes, kick sets, like I said. But, you know, when with triathletes, if we're trying to do drills, it's very rushed through. People just want to get the yard in. They want to count the 50 yards and they don't really care about the drill. It's okay to step back and not do it on a fast interval. Slow down, focus on the drills. There is a time and there's a necessity and there's a place for that in your swim training, even as a triathlete.
So what kind of kick sets are you talking about? How far would you go?
Didi knows this. I'm the worst kicker probably in the world. I was pretty sure I was going to get cut from the Navy team when the coach saw me on a kick set. He was like visibly pissed at me. I'm like, this is what I got, coach. I was pretty sure I was going to get the X. When we go to Australia, we train with an age group club team. Very fast swimmers, and I get to put fins on because I'm the old guy that can't kick. But yeah, you're doing it could be a K or 1500 meter kick set towards the end of the practice, which I don't necessarily think you need in triathlon. Like I said, time is a commodity, but the way that swimmers can focus on certain parts of the stroke, whether it's kick or pulling, with a little more detail, I think. It's a big advantage.
Kicking has become such a big part, certainly, of swim training, that one of the things that woman who spent some time training with us, our triathlon squad, who is still a proper swimmer at Stanford, one of the things she relayed about their swim training is that they have one session a week that is just kicking. They may warm up a 500 swimming, and then the rest of the workout is all kicking. So the kick is such an important part of the swim stroke. Now in triathlon, it's different, right? So the kick is adding propulsion to the stroke, and that is a much more key component for pool swimmers. It is a propulsive force to your stroke. For triathletes wearing wetsuits, you're going to be using your legs an awful lot during the rest of the day. So the kick becomes, yes, somewhat about propulsion, but more about timing and balance in the water. But it's still an important skill that we as triathletes don't spend any time hardly doing, because most people are terrible at it. And the other thing I would say is, if you have the time, do your kicking without the fins and try to figure it out. Like, what makes me faster? Do I focus on the up kick, the down kick, both the amplitude of the kick, the frequency of the kick, and things like that?
That's a lot of things to think about that I had never
considered
before.
That's my favorite part of this whole podcast, Edie. That was great. Yeah, no, I'm serious. That was wonderful. Good insight.
Yeah. And there you go. That just goes to show that when you are swimming, these are all of the things that you can be thinking about in the monotony that some people might consider to be swimming and doing those massive kick sets. I did a 50 yesterday without fins on, and I was like, why is this taking so long? I need to do this more often. So thank you for giving me that idea that yes, I do need to take the fins off. And also some things to think about when you're kicking, being consciously aware of what you're doing with your legs. That's golden. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. We're going to switch a bit of a direction here. So pure swimmers, they spend way more time wearing goggles in the chlorine than triathletes do. So are there any next level swim gear best practices triathletes should adopt from pure swimmers? What do you think, Tim?
Goggle choice. Just say no to those big masks. Like, just if you're like this, like, just get some goggles. You'll be fine. Some normal goggles.
Can I add one more? The logos on the cap go on the sides of your head, not the front and the back. So when you put your swim cap on, the logos go on either side, so that when you're swimming, the people on the side of the pool can see the logo. They don't go front and back. That's just a hashtag pro tip.
Yeah. I love that tip.
These are all like, tell me you're a triathlete without telling me you're a triathlete. Like little warning signs.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So is there anything that you can suggest for like foggy goggles? Because a lot of people struggle with foggy goggles, especially in open water swims, I find. Are there any tips and tricks for that one?
I mean, you can buy any fog, which really help. You're actually not supposed to get your lens wet before the swim, and that can actually ruin the anti-fog on there. So, a lot of people are like throwing water in. That That's actually a no-no. So don't do that. Or I, you know, honestly, if it's a big race, I would always wear new goggles. Obviously, it's got to be the style brand that you are used to wearing. So it's not a new fit. You know that they work. You know they don't leak. But they always come coated with anti-fog. So fresh pair of goggles on a big race, an Ironman, you've already spent over a thousand bucks entry plus travel. You're a couple grand into this thing. Go treat yourself to a new pair of goggles.
Yep. And the other thing I would add to that is I always, always, always bring an extra pair of goggles down to the swim start so that if I am putting my goggles on and the nose piece breaks or the strap does something kooky or all of a sudden there's a last minute mishap, you don't want the sudden panic of, oh my gosh, I don't have goggles. I always bring a second pair down. And as I'm getting into the water and everything seems good to go, I'll just hand them to an official or an announcer and say, hey, if anybody has a goggle malfunction, here's an extra pair. And it's my pay it forward to the rest of the field. But having an extra pair of goggles, either, you know, if you have a support person that's close to the swim start that you can hand them off to, or just have a backup pair. As Tim said, you've made a big investment to be there. Be prepared for all of the eventualities.
That's really, really kind of you, Dee Dee. I love that so much. That's so wonderful. Can you imagine? I just got a pair of goggles from Dee Dee Griesbauer.
And then me. That's epic. I love it. Because she took the new pair and gave me the used pair.
Oh, that Dee Dee. Many of us triathletes are, you know, pretty diligent about fueling for bike and run sessions. But we often forget a little fuel and hydration can be helpful in the pool as well. So what are swimmers doing for their fueling in their sessions? Like, those are pretty long sessions that they're putting in. Should we follow what they're doing?
Well, again, sports nutrition has evolved. When I swam, we did not. And this is, honest to God, true story, I didn't even have a water bottle on the deck. I walked out with my gear bag and that was it. And I'd be in the water for 2.5 hours with no calories, no electrolyte, no water. Like we didn't have water bottles on the deck. I think it was probably one or two generations of swimmers after me at Stanford where they finally had the big igloo cooler and you could like go get a cup of water in the middle of the, you know, it wasn't on our radar. I mean, fueling outside of the sport certainly was, but fueling during the swim, we just, not even a water bottle, which is why almost every swim, if you get in the water after our squad gets out, I've left my water bottle there. So there you go, my gift again. I leave bottles everywhere at the
and
pool.
It's probably full.
It's probably full. That's how I was brought up in the sport. And I think there is, you know, I think Brett Sutton's a big, you know, advocate of no fueling during the swim because you don't fuel during the swim in an Ironman race. But I think in this particular case, training is very different than racing in that you will perform better in training and get more out of your session if you are properly fueled, which does mean oftentimes electrolyte, water, and oftentimes a gel or two on the side of the deck if you feel like you're starting to slide off the cliff, I think is good to top up your calories during your swim.
Yeah, and I think timing a day with those sessions too, right, Dee Dee? You know, if it's your first session of the day and it's early morning, you know, maybe you don't need four goos in the swim. But if you just come off of a very hard run and then you're expected to do a threshold swim, Julie, you might need a couple gels.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I notice for myself when I do the swim, I find that I don't necessarily need something during the swim, but if I don't have something immediately after, I feel horrible for the rest of the day. And that includes the electrolyte top up and the carbs and protein that are needed after the session. So I think that's a really valid point that you make.
And one more point on that, Vanessa. You have to also remember that your body is very inefficient at using calories when you're swimming in the water because you're in a cool environment. If you know, even if the water is 84, you're, you know, 15 degrees, 14 degrees below your body temperature. So in terms of efficiency, it is way less efficient than riding or running in terms of every like what percent of your calories in actually go to moving your muscles and, you know, propelling you through the water. A lot of it's heat regulation. So There's a reason why you feel super hungry after a long session, because your body was working really hard to stay warm and it's burning a lot of calories. So fueling during the session helps you lessen the burden of what you need to replenish afterwards, which is another way to think about, you know, fueling during a session, and that it is okay to fuel during a session, because everything you do during and after is going to help you the next day and the day after that, because nutrition can really lead to cumulative effects in the negative proportion.
So just a little side question off of that. Is there a certain amount of time that you would indicate that you would want to fuel in the pool? Like if your session is less than an hour, do you think you need to fuel in the pool? Or if it's more than an hour, what time frame are we looking at for adding those carb sources in?
I think it depends on what you've done before and what you're planning to do after. Like Tim said, if you've come from a hard run and you're, you know, for time management, just going to get all your sessions done stacked up, you definitely need to fuel it probably more than you would if that's your only session of the day and you've just had breakfast and it's a 45-minute session and then you're going home and going off to whatever the rest of your day is. So I think how it stacks up with the rest of your day's obligations depends a lot on how and how much you would fuel. But I think it's a great practice, no matter what, to just get in the habit of having sort of those two scoops of recovery, whatever, with some protein, some carb, and some electrolyte in your bottle, just to sip on it while you're in your car going off to whatever it is that's next. I think that refueling is absolutely critical on every session. But the fueling during, I think, depends a little bit. Like if I'm going into a 60 to 90 minute swim and it's like a solo session, I will have had breakfast and maybe an hour later I'm doing that session. I wouldn't fuel it probably at all. And then just have a post-workout something.
There can be a lot of anxiety about the swim part of the triathlon. Are we alone in that? Do pure swimmers have similar anxiety? And what can triathletes learn from swimmers when it comes to entering the water with more confidence?
You know, I think swimmers have the advantage in that they are already naturally comfortable in the water, in the environment. I even noticed that when I was in the Navy, went to dive school, just not having, you know, done any scuba dive training before, my comfort in the water was a huge advantage. But open water is a different beast. And I have seen swimmers, very good swimmers, not be able to handle that environment just for the unknowns or whatever you want to call it. So I think there's kind of two different elements at play here in this comfort equation.
Yeah, I actually had this. I had this conversation with a blast from the past, Kim Loeffler, retired pro. She's been retired a good long time, and she was a collegiate runner, very good runner. And we got into it one time debating. She's like, "You're just so lucky." She's like, "You're a good swimmer. You don't have any of that stress or anxiety. You get knocked in the swim, you don't care. You just take it in stride and move on." She's like, it's such an advantage to be a good swimmer. And I was like, okay, Kim, I'm going to do the math for you. Like, I'm a good swimmer. I get out of an Ironman swim at the time in about 50 minutes, it's a couple of minutes more than that now. But at the time, it was about 50 minutes. I was like, you're not as strong a swimmer and it might take you just over an hour. So I have a 12-minute lead on you. I'm like, you've got 5 hours on the bike and 3+ hours on the run to catch me. I'm like, the math does not work in my favor. But her point was the anxiety. And I think what I advise swimmers and people who are uncomfortable in the water, and it actually comes back to what you said in your opening sentences, Vanessa. I think how I got to be a good swimmer and love the water was playing in the pool. Like the pool was my babysitter in the summertime. My parents would drop me off and be like, "We'll be back at 5, you know, have a good time." And we would be doing dolphin dive races and dropping down to the bottom of the pool with our goggles on and trying to count the tiles on the bottom of the pool. And we call it I call it silly strokes, like grabbing your right arm with your left hand and trying to swim from one end of the pool to the other. It's playing in the water. But as adults, we get in and we try to swim laps and we've got our watches and we're trying to pay attention to, you know, the workout and, oh, I got to get my goggles on and I got to hit my watch and the buttons. We don't get in the water and play and just be in the water and hang out underwater and do things underwater and feel the water and play those kind of games where, yeah, you're not swimming efficiently because I'm holding my left ankle with my right hand, but doing stuff like that forces you to feel the water and figure out how to move your body through the water, sculling backwards and upside down, I think are great tools to learn how to move your body in the water and therefore to be more comfortable in it.
So what you're essentially suggesting is that if we have anxiety in the water, we need to go and
play in the water.
And feel the joy of being in the water, because it is very joyful. And I know from coaching, I coach this this beginner triathlon group. And when I look at the athletes, the range of swim ability is like, it's so massive. But you can tell who loves being in the water. You can see in just the way that they move their bodies. It's like they're having a really good time enjoying themselves in the water. And so I think that you just really hit home with that point, is that learn to love being in the water, and that will allow you to feel relaxed and less anxious. And recently I had the pleasure of attending one of the Tri-Dot pool schools, and it was an amazing experience, both in the community that was built and also in all of the knowledge that I gathered from those hours in the pool. Tim, I know that you've been to pool school as well. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how the technique that was delivered in pool school, how that translated, and if it was a good measure of the technique that you learned when you were an athlete as a swimmer.
Well, Vanessa, we touched on this earlier, and Didi mentioned how hard it is to make changes to your stroke, particularly when you don't see it. So being in an environment like pool school, where you have other people watching you, giving you feedback, much like if you get the opportunity to swim with the master's group and have a coach on deck, having those eyes on you is so important for you being able to productively make changes to your stroke. And when I went to pool school, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I thought it was going to be a sham. I'm like, there's no way that these guys are going to be dropping this much time. So I was like, I wasn't expecting much, and I was blown away. I got in the pool. I did all the drills. I got faster by the end of the weekend, but most importantly, I saw how much faster all the age group athletes were getting. I mean, we're talking massive time drops per 100, 10, 12, some people 20 seconds per 100. And I love the drills, not just because of the drills, but the way they were put out to the athletes, the way they were explained, the visualizations that were given to them. It was almost like drills that I knew I should do, but better cues so I could remember how to do them, and a logical order to help you actually progress your stroke. And I said to Jeff afterwards, all right, you're right. I was wrong. You are smart. I am not very smart. That is amazing. So now we're working on hopefully getting one in Boulder here soon. So stay tuned. We might be having one with me on deck this time and not in the water, helping you all realize the greatness that is Tri-Dot Pool School.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
I sure am excited about our coach cool down tip today, everyone. I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. We have Brady Hoover in the house, and he is here to talk to us about strength training. He has too many certifications to list, so we'll just say he holds rock star status across many disciplines, from strength training to running. Speaking of running, he is blazing fast, y'all. Not only is he a 7-time Boston Marathon qualifier and a 6-time finisher, he holds a 2:48 marathon PB and a 16:34 5K PB. He claims that he has slowed down a little bit because he has two insanely energetic little kids. Wonder where they get their energy from. But I'm pretty sure that his current zone 2 is my zone 6, so we'll just say that he is fast. Brady is a personal trainer for most of the hours of his week and a triathlon coach for the remainder. He has been a triathlon coach since 2016 and with Tri-Dot since 2019. He mainly coaches intermediate to top age groupers who often finish on the podium, I might add, and has helped many an athlete qualify and race in the Boston Marathon. Something that many people do not know about Brady is that he has some unfinished business in the tri world. Would you like to share with everyone what this is, Brady?
Oh, yes. I am hungry, hungry, hungry for Kona. You know, I was training for Ironman in Arizona, and I knew that was not the race that was going to get me that qualification. It was my second Ironman, but I had made mistakes and learned from my mistakes of my first Ironman that I was going to do better and move up in the rankings in Arizona. And I screwed up my nutrition, you know. So I don't know where I messed up in the competition, but, you know, by my estimation, I lost about 20 minutes due to my error. But I knew that wasn't the one that was going to get me to Kona. I knew I needed another year of training. So I was planning on racing Mount Tremblant 2020. And we all know what happened in 2020. We had the pandemic, everything shut down. Yeah. And that's when we had our second child, right before the pandemic. So it would have worked really well leading up into Tremblant, you know, having an infant, because it's a little bit easier when they're not running around. COVID derailed everything. So I still got my sights on it, but, you know, right now I don't have the time to put in that kind of volume. So my secret to success right now is, you know, staying in that developmental phase, staying strong, doing my strength training, getting stronger, so that when I do have that chance to come back, I know exactly what I got to do to execute on race day, to give myself that, you know, that chance.
There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that you will realize this dream someday. And if you're ever having a tough day and need some cheerleading, you know who to call. I'll share my enthusiasm with you to make you feel unstoppable, even though you already are unstoppable. But we're here for a tip. So let's hear your strength training tip for us today.
So strength today is talking about muscle imbalances. Muscle imbalances most often lead to injury. Let's take the IT band syndrome, for instance, is one I like to go to because it's so, so common in our sport. Typically with all the pounding of running, especially running downhills, puts a lot of stress and overdevelops our quads. You know, we're pushing down on those pedals when we're cycling. We can put out a lot more power pushing down than we can pulling up. If we're not strength training, this is going to cause imbalances. It's going to cause a weaker glute. And because of that, our hips aren't going to be able to stabilize. So every stride we take, you can only imagine what that adds up to be. After a few weeks ramping everything up, if your hips can't stabilize, you're going to get hurt. So strength training for longevity in the sport is a must. It's something that should not be skipped. So if you're not doing it yet, you need to start.
And what are some of the ways that an athlete can check to see where they might have some of these imbalances?
Good question, Vanessa. So best thing to do would be to go to a local gym, sign up, and have a functional movement screening done. Or if you know a personal trainer, some of us are certified in functional movement screening. We can actually put an athlete through a screening, and we can see, you know, the biggest highlight, especially for IT band syndrome, is the hurdle step, where we'll measure the inseam of the athlete's leg and we will set up a hurdle to the right height. That athlete should be able to stabilize on one foot, lift that leg up high in the air, extend at the hamstring, and step over that hurdle. They may lose balance. We're not after that. It's how is that leg getting over the hurdle? Do they have to swing it out to the left? Do they have to swing it out to the right? They should be able to lift up and put it directly straight out in front of them and over that hurdle step. If they can't do that, often the reason why is because they lack glute strength and hamstrings.
And what are some of the most common imbalance issues that you usually see?
Weak core and weak glutes.
That is something that I've heard a lot, even in the general population, is weak glutes, because we sit so much, you know, we have improper movement when we do use them. Because they're not firing properly. And have you heard, I don't know if this is actually a real thing, but have you heard of the term glute amnesia? Is that actually a thing?
I haven't heard that term, but, you know, I ask everybody, to my clients that I see in the gym, they're not athletes. And my first question is, what do you do for a living? Because I want to know, are they on their feet all day or are they sitting all day? Because if they're sitting all day, they're going to have overdeveloped quads. They're going to have weak glutes, weak hamstrings, and a weak core because they're, you know, not sitting in that chair correctly. So I know exactly how I'm going to program for them and where I'm going to start them.
Right. And so it sounds like
For a lot of people, there's a big importance for strengthening everything in the posterior chain. Like if we're all just, you know, quad dominant and we have this lack of strength in the glutes, it sounds like everything on that backside of the body should be something that we need to take care of.
Yeah. So, you know, simple programming would be like, you know, especially for us athletes, is for every push, we should be doing two pulls. Unless our body is in balance, then we can do a 1-to-1. But most people I work with, it's like a 1-to-2. I work with a dentist and it's like a 1-to-3 because they're, you know, they're sitting in the chair, they're hunched over, their shoulders are round and forward, they got shoulder pain, their body is a mess. Hairdressers as well. Hairdressers though, not so bad because they're standing, but, you know, I see the same common problems between hairdressers and dentists. Triathletes always, you know, generally a weak core, generally round, you know, shoulders rounding forward, because they're lacking in strength. They don't do their stretches. If you want longevity in this sport, it's absolutely critical that you strength train.
Okay. So can you give us two exercises that could help to strengthen the posterior side of the body?
Yeah. So, you know, starting in kind of a prep phase, pre-foundational phase before we get to our strength phase, single leg deadlift is one of my go-tos. I love the single leg deadlift. You know, you're selecting a lightweight, staying in a 10 to 12 rep kind of range because we want to develop good movement patterns in that before we load it with some heavier weights and drop that rep count and increase the stress where we start working with that heavier weight. So we want to be strong on that single leg before we load it on two legs. Oftentimes people want to go and they want a barbell deadlift and it's like, yeah, you could do that, but you should really start with the single leg deadlift, get really strong, get the movement patterns down there. Because imagine if you can do it on one leg, what can you do on two, especially when you're stable?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that would be one. And I do like the wide grip lat pull down. I do see people do this wrong too, is they grab that lat pull down bar up ahead of them. Their shoulders are rounded forward. And I always say, set those shoulders back ever so slightly. You should feel your lats before you even pull down. So pull those shoulders back and then go ahead and pull that bar down, right down just below your chin.
That's a really great cue actually, when you're doing that exercise. I think it's even built into some of the Tri-Dot strength videos, is the band pull down. And that's a really good cue, is to just drop your shoulders and pull them back before you start to engage on that movement. So yeah, that's great.
High volume swimmers that we are, those of us that are training for half distance and full distance Ironmans, I mean, we are just so tight in the front of the shoulder. So it's absolutely critical. You actually have to think about pulling those shoulders back when you're pulling down. Otherwise, you're just reinforcing bad movement.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the Tri-Dot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to Tri-Dot.com and start your free trial today. Tri-Dot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.